Thank you, Jonathan. Good to be back. We skipped the end of April due to the double whammy of tax season at an accounting firm and Pesach. So this is our first since the end of March. And our topic is a topic which, frankly, I wanted to do a month ago because it was, you know, more in the headlines then than it is now. Nonetheless, certainly still relevant. The Panama Papers, Ethical Taxation and Tax Avoidance. Background on this, aside from what the Panama Papers are, I think people are generally aware, so I don't think that needs a lot of introduction. But the difference between tax evasion and tax avoidance. Tax evasion being where you are obligated to pay a certain amount and you decide not to. Tax avoidance, where you structure your finances in such a way that that you actually avoid an obligation, where if you present it one way, you will be obligated. You present it another way, you will not be obligated. And so that's one of the main topics I want to address, is this question of whether that's considered ethical within Judaism. Canada has a funny relationship with tax avoidance, in the sense that, on the one hand, tax avoidance by definition should be legal, in the sense that you just structure it such that you take advantage of a loophole within the law. On the other hand, I've learned that Section 245 of the Income Tax Act actually tries to prevent tax avoidance. If you take a look at the first source on your sheet, where a transaction is an avoidance transaction, which we'll define in a moment, the tax consequences to a person shall be determined as is reasonable in the circumstances in order to deny a tax benefit that, but for this section, would result directly or indirectly from that transaction or series of transactions that includes that transaction. In other words, when you engage in a transaction which we are going to characterize as an avoidance transaction, which could result in you owing less in taxes, we're going to tax you anyway, as though you hadn't engaged in that avoidance transaction at all. So, what is an avoidance transaction? Any transaction that, but for this section, would result directly or indirectly in a tax benefit, unless the transaction may reasonably be considered to have been undertaken or arranged primarily for bona fide purposes other than to obtain the tax benefit. In other words, to take out the legalese, you engage in a transaction for no reason other than to avoid taxes. It can't be explained as being done for any purpose other than avoiding a tax hit. So that's what we call an avoidance transaction, because that's the goal of it. And what we're going to do is pretend you didn't do it. We'll tax you as though you had not engaged in that avoidance transaction, or if it's part of a series of transactions, as the statute continues. So, are we clear on the basis? I wasn't planning on going into specific examples of avoidance transactions. If you want, I can send you a link to a whole bunch of examples in a publication from the CRA. But we have a basic sense of what an avoidance transaction is. You engage in a deal that is meant entirely for the purpose of avoiding being taxed. So tax avoidance, aside from being something that the government tries to avert, is also something that has become a little bit unpopular since the publication of the Panama Papers. As these papers divulged the dealings of people, often entirely legal, to move their financial dealings offshore in order to avoid taxation, the result has been a hit on the reputation of both companies and individuals, often politicians. They look bad. So much so that I actually understand from people who work in this field that companies who used to come to them and say, structure this for me so that you can minimize my tax burden, are now thinking twice about it because they understand the damage to them if it becomes public. They don't want to be seen as bad citizens. So you're actually seeing companies go the other direction now in response to it. But the two questions that I want to address are, first of all, ethical taxation, meaning the Canadian income tax is a progressive tax in which, depending on how much you earn, that will determine what percentage of your income you have to give. So that you earn less, you only have to give whatever the percentage. I'm going to make up numbers. 15%. You earn more, you may have to give 30%, 35%, 40%, whatever it is. So that your rate changes depending on how much you're earning. That's a progressive tax. However, the classic tax within Torah, within Jewish law, bless you, is that what would you say is the example of the classic tax within Judaism?
Opposite.
No,
well, the half shekel would be an example.
That's a head tax.
Exactly. There's a head tax. The half shekel that was given to the temple, to the Beis HaMikdash. Chaim mentions Meiser, where you give 10% of your income. These are flat taxes, right? They don't change. So would Judaism recognize a progressive tax? I ask the question because in the aftermath of the publication of the Panama Papers, I actually wrote something about this issue and about avoiding taxes, and somebody said to me, well, you know, Judaism doesn't necessarily recognize a progressive tax. Judaism does not recognize a progressive tax. It really likes a flat tax, as given in those examples. So I want to look at the question of whether Judaism in fact likes a progressive tax. That's question number one. And then question number two is directly about tax avoidance. Everything we have, if you don't, please don't close the doors entirely. Someone might want to come in. Who knows? But each of Judaism's own taxes has potential loopholes. And so the question is, how would we view tax avoidance within Jewish taxes? And that's the second question. So are we clear on what we want to address? We want to address whether Judaism likes a progressive tax, and we want to address the question of how Judaism feels about making use of loopholes to avoid taxation. So generally speaking, you have to start... Yeah?
Is the implication of whether Judaism likes it or not, that if it doesn't like it, then you have grounds for avoiding it? Is that...
Well, that was the argument that somebody gave to me, that maybe even if Judaism doesn't like avoiding taxes in general, if it doesn't approve of this system, so maybe that Judaism would not object to avoiding. I'm not talking about evading, but avoiding. The critical difference between the two. Saying that, look, we don't believe that this is right. So therefore, if there's a legal way for me to get around paying it, then I'm going to get around paying it. That would be the argument. So the truth of the matter is, we've already mentioned a couple of taxes that exist within Judaism. If you define tax broadly as a mandatory distribution of your income to benefit the community, there are more taxes within the Jewish community. You have, yes, the half shekel that was given every year to the temple. It supported its construction, and then it also supported the daily karbanah, the daily offerings. You also have maser ksafim, the practice of giving 10% of one's income to the needy. You also have all the agricultural taxes, right? Truma, 1/60, maser, giving, or what, there's actually, it's an adjustable ratio, but let's call it 1/60. The maser, that's 1/10, that went for different causes. There are the gleanings which you leave in the field for the needy, the first fruits are given. There are a whole bunch of different taxes that exist within the Torah's set of laws. We are generally speaking obligated to pay taxes both within the Jewish community and within the secular community. I brought you a source that I thought was interesting in number two. That is one reason why we pay taxes. It requires a little bit of analysis. I think it's worthwhile. Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, writing in 13th century Spain, was asked a question about funding a cantor for the community. They wanted to have a chazan. Ulinyan shliach tzibur, regarding the cantor, he says, you asked me the question of whether you can hire him using funds from the communal tzedakah fund, assuming he is a paid cantor. Right? We want to hire a cantor for the community. The rabbi has a discretionary fund that's meant to be used for tzedakah. Can you use communal tzedakah funds to pay the cantor? What would you assume?
No.
I would have assumed no, right? Like Jonathan says, like Janice says, like you the tzedakah money is meant to pay, you know, to pay for the needs of indigent people. So look at what he says. He says, even though he, meaning the cantor, fulfills the obligation for needy and wealthy alike, the cantor is leading services for everyone, nonetheless, the needy are not able to afford in the way that the wealthy people can. If you're going to say that the community is responsible to pay, like a head tax, where you'll say, well, everybody benefits from this person equally, and therefore, we'll just say, if you're paying him X amount of money. Divide X by number of citizens and let each citizen pay that number. He says the needy can't afford it. And the rule is that everything that is for the needs of the community and is done by money, is paid based on financial means. Meaning, you're not going to say that this should be a head tax. Rather, what you're going to say, I think it's back to the beginning.
Yes.
We're not going to make it a head tax. Rather, it's really based on your means, and therefore, when you pay out of the community staka fund, you're effectively paying the share of the needy people who can't afford it.
Is it maybe looking at it from another point of view and saying, if you don't take it out of there, and the, let's say the more wealthy people were to pay for it, they would give less to the, they would take it off what they give to the
right, so he doesn't actually say that. That's not what, it's an interesting view. And after the recorder is off, I'll tell you a story involving that. But the I think that his point in general is we look at what you pay for the cantor as tzedakah to the needy people who aren't able to pay their share. And what I'm extrapolating from that is that in general, when you're paying taxes towards communal funds, which needier people aren't able to afford, what you're doing is fundamentally an act of tzedakah. Some like to argue this regarding day school tuition, that the amount that you pay to the school is not only covering your own child's tuition, it's also covering tuition for people who are on subsidy, who aren't able to pay, and therefore they want to argue that part of what they're giving the school actually is tzedakah. And I've seen that argument in terms of ma'aser ksafim, the practice of giving 10% of your income to charity. They'll say, well, tell me what is over and above my own child's rate, what that's costing the school. It's a little difficult to do accounting-wise. But the argument is, that's really tzedakah to the community, because I'm paying for somebody else's child to get an education. And that's one rationale.
Yeah. So different than people who pay for shul dues and appeals to shul habits.
Correct.
If your shul happens to have a cousin, it would be paid out of the same funds as well.
Right. Much to my chagrin. But yes. That's a personal comment. The British and South Africans may disagree. But I think that's a key point that the Rashba is making in number two of Shlomo Ibn Aderet. It is saying that we view our obligation to pay taxes as an obligation of chesed, of kindness to others. There are other reasons to pay taxes, right? Promoting peace within the community in general, because if you don't give, then people are going to get upset. And the ground rule of Dina demachusa dina. The law of the land is the law. And this is actually, I took the time to spell it out in number three, because this is the source. The tax discussion is the source in the Talmud for the statement that you have to honor the law of the land. Take a look at number three, please. There's a Mishnah which begins the discussion by saying you're not allowed to make change using money from the tax collector's box. In other words, there's a tax collector. I need to get change. I go to him and I say, here's a large coin, will you give me change out of the box? No, you're not allowed to. Why? Why not?
Because somebody will suspect that you're stealing.
Nope. Because the tax collector was considered a thief. And therefore you're benefiting from stolen goods. If you take his money, you're using it, that's stolen goods.
But with a stack of box, it's okay.
The tzedakah will be fine, although you should also add a little bit, but that's another discussion. So, in number three, though, the sages ask, in their commentary to the Mishnah, don't I have a statement from the sage Shmuel in the 3rd century? He said, the law of the kingdom is the law, dina demachusa dina, and therefore the tax collector is justified. This isn't stolen goods at all. To which they explain there are two different kinds of tax collectors. You have a tax collector who, in the first explanation there, is not given a fixed amount to collect. You're familiar with the phrase tax farmer? Anybody know what a tax farmer is? Tax farming was a practice in the days of the Roman Empire in which people would buy from the government the right to collect taxes, and then they would tax as they saw fit. So in other words, the government said, we could make $5 billion if we collect taxes. But it's going to cost us an investment of $2 billion just to do it. So some guy comes along and says, I'll pay you $4 billion for the rights to collect taxes. We're going to make money on it. We'll sell him the right to collect taxes. He can do whatever he wants. He can set up a toll booth. He can go house to house. He can decide that his friends pay X and his, you know, enemies pay Y. And that was what would happen. And so the Talmud says, that guy's a thief. He doesn't have a fixed amount to collect. That's one example. The other example that they bring from the yeshiva of Rabbi Yanai was a self-appointed tax collector. A self-appointed tax collector is another way to say bandit. Right? He sets up a toll booth and says, okay, if you want to go here, you have to pay a tax. So he says, the key point for us is, if it's a tax collector who's government-appointed, who has a known set of rules by which he taxes, and it's a fair set of rules, then you're obligated to pay the tax. That's the law of the land. There's a lot of discussion as to why exactly Jewish law recognizes the authority of the government, but it's beyond the scope of our discussion right now. The bottom line is that Jewish law says, I am obligated to pay my taxes. The fact that you may know someone somewhere who doesn't pay properly doesn't change the fact that Jewish law says, yes, I'm obligated to pay taxes. However, tax avoidance, again, aside from section 245 in source number one, tax avoidance is generally considered legal. You're allowed to structure your finances in such a way that you'll avoid responsibility. I brought you from an article called Jewish Ethical Perspectives to American Taxation from the Rutgers Journal of Law and Religion. This fellow, Kenneth Rayeski, who writes the following. Nevertheless, quote, anyone may so arrange his affairs that his taxes shall be as low as possible. He is not bound to choose that pattern which will best pay the treasury. There is not even a patriotic duty to increase one's taxes. And that's from a legal decision in the U.S. from 1935. Another quote. One is not required to arrange his or her affairs so that the government will receive more tax than it is rightfully owed, nor is it fraudulent to construe an ambiguous law in a manner that is adverse to the government. If you decide that the law says X, and X means I don't have to pay, you know, the government may, you know, take you to court over it. They may express their opinion, but you're allowed to interpret it legitimately in a way that exempts you from taxation.
Is this just under the heading of the meaning? How does Yadu talk about, maybe, am I allowed to structure my affairs in order that I give the kupata kahal less? I mean, or are we talking only about...
So that's where we have to go with this. No, that's exactly where we have to go in part two. No, part one is going to be the discussion of which system of taxation we like. Part two is going to be exactly that question. Not only how do I feel about tax avoidance secularly, but how do I feel about tax avoidance in terms of my duties to the community on any level. Both of these are going to be significant, absolutely. So there's actually a story that goes around online, although I discovered that it's not true, but it's a nice story anyway, about a lecture by Judge Louis Brandeis. That he said that he lived in Virginia. I'm blanking on the town, but on his way to the Supreme Court, if he was in a rush, so he would take the toll bridge. But if he wasn't in a rush, he took a longer route, and there was a free bridge that you could take. And he said, "I'm actually doing a service to the community because I'm reducing the burden of traffic on the toll bridge, and I should be applauded for the fact that I'm doing this." And he says, "The tragedy is that nobody knows that there actually is this free bridge." Unfortunately, the story is not true, because once he joined the Supreme Court, he actually lived in Washington, D.C. He didn't live in Virginia, so the story is false, but everybody quotes it anyway. That may be also. I don't know. This was 50 years ago. 60 years ago. Anyway, let's talk about systems of taxation. So I drew heavily on a great article. There's a set of three articles by a professor at University of Arizona. Adam, I'm not sure how he pronounces his last name. I would pronounce it Khodorov, even though it's written with a W at the end. He did a lot of work on this. I don't agree with everything he wrote, but he put in a lot of thought in terms of Judaism and its approaches to different types of taxation. You'll see his articles quoted on here. They're available online. So some have argued that we should study the Torah's text in order to figure out what tax rates ought to be. This is great. If you take a look at source number 5, this is a paper from 2002, An Argument for Tax Reform Based on Judeo-Christian Ethics, in the Alabama Law Review. by Professor Susan Pace Hamill. And she says, from a divine perspective, no person or group of persons, regardless of their station in life, stands at a lesser level of importance than other persons, because all persons were created in God's image. And she goes on from there to lobby for a tax system that is progressive in order to protect the vulnerable. That's her basic argument, is that Alabama should redo the way it does its state taxes in order to aid the vulnerable. Well, her paper was influential. There's a governor in Alabama named Bob Riley who actually took this on as a campaign. If you take a look at number 6, this is a review of what happened called The Social Gospel Lays an Egg in Alabama, which now you don't even need to read the source because you already can tell where it's going. When newly elected Governor Bob Riley, a stalwart low-tax Republican and standard-bearer for the religious right, took a page from the liberal Protestant playbook and announced that the Christian way to solve Alabama's huge budget deficit was to raise taxes, Alabamians and journalists all over the country were amazed. But in the end, no, the voters rejected it and it didn't work. But there are those who make this argument that you should look at our system and say, well, what does God want? So Khadarab's suggestion is that you have to be more complex in the way that you look at the Jewish system of taxation, because there really is more than one model within Judaism, and none of them clearly match up to the needs of a modern Western economy. He says, one basic tax is the one that we already mentioned, the half shekel that goes to the temple. Every adult male, it was males for this, it started out as a military census for those between the age of 20 and 60. So every male was supposed to give the same amount, and as I brought you in source number 7, classic verse, the rich shall not exceed and the poor shall not reduce. Everybody gives the same amount, l'chaper al nafshotechem, to atone for your lives. So it's a flathead tax. However, as Khadarov notes, it's difficult to argue that this is going to be a basis now. Why isn't this a good model for our system?
It can't be changed. It's not different. It was a different type of living.
Well, there was there were classes regardless.
You were doing it for other motivation, was it?
Okay, so Mara makes a good point that I'm going to come back to. Chaim, what were you going to say? I'm going to come back to your point.
There was one very limited, specific expense that tax was going towards. It was Michigan. It wasn't going towards roads and firemen and military and all these other hospitals. So
right.
To do a flat head tax, it wouldn't work at all.
Well, you just have to raise the amount you're demanding from each head.
But then the higher you raise it, the fewer people can do it.
Right. So Chaim points out that this is the least common denominator tax. You're really requiring a very minimal amount, and once your needs grow, this becomes ineffective. And it's a good point. Martin's point also, though, is that this has a very different purpose to it, and that's why I brought you the end of the sentence in number 7. Now, the goal is, l'chaper al nafshotechem, the goal is atonement before God. In other words, this isn't about how I relate to other people and making sure that we have a nice, even tax within society. It's about my connection to God. And by having this flat tax, you make a very nice statement that God wants each person to have a relationship with Him, and that you give it half, and there are all those sorts of nice thoughts about why you're giving half a coin instead of a whole coin, showing that none of us are whole. Like, it's about the relationship with God. It's not about taxation of the society. The second model that he considers is the agricultural taxes, the tithes that are given, which he considers a proportional income tax, because it's a percentage of your income, right? You have to give, let's call it 2% of your produce is going to go to the Kohen, that's Truma. You're going to give another 10% to the Levi, to the Levite, that's Maaser Rishon. Another 10%, in some years, you take to Jerusalem and you eat it there, and in other years, you give it to the needy. Either it's Maaser Sheni or Maaser Ani. These are all percentages, but it's the same percentage for everybody. It doesn't matter if you're a needy person with produce or a wealthy person with produce. You have to give the same percentages. So it's called a proportional income tax. So is this going to be a model for us? What would you say? Should that be a model? And say, everybody then, based on their income, pays the same thing. It's what, in the U.S., there was a candidate for office, I don't know, it was about 20 years ago, named Steve Forbes, who proposed a flat tax. this was when I was first starting to become aware of what was going on in terms of economics and governments, and that's what sticks in my head. Everybody pays the same percentage. Does that make sense? Should we be extrapolating from that system to our system of taxation? So the answer, I think, is no, for a few reasons. Number one, not all of the agricultural taxes actually are based on fixed proportions. There's the rule of gleaning, where we say that if you drop produce in the field, then the paupers get to collect it. There's no percentage, it's just if you dropped it, leave it. Or if you skip the spot, leave it behind. It isn't a flat percentage of your produce entirely. It's more complex than that. That's number one. Number two, Chodorov argues, and I think he's onto something, that it could be that within the biblical system of agricultural taxation, you need to have a flat percentage because it's already such a difficult system to implement in terms of figuring out which types of produce are obligated, when they're obligated, who qualifies to receive a distribution. It's already complicated enough. You're going to add another layer to it and say, oh, and by the way, if your income is below X, then you give this percentage. If your income is higher, then you give that percentage. You'll drive people out of their mind, and they won't. They're not going to do it. It's in an agrarian society that's not computer-based. You know, it's not going to work from a practical perspective. But he also notes an additional problem. Yeah. Right, they do exist.
I'm saying that whatever existed before still applied today.
Right.
To some extent.
Correct. The question is not so much can it work today. In fact, you're right. It does exist, and the VAT form would be a good example of it. The question is, in my mind, it is a model that we should be using across the board. The question is, if the proportional income tax existed for them, is that something that's meant to be guidance that we should now be doing in our communities beyond the VAT, you know, as an overall?
Well, no one tax provides the basis for everyone to contribute.
Right.
So that's why there are multiple forms of taxation. That could be why there were multiple forms of taxation when the nation was first being formed.
Right. So, but what you're saying then is, I mean, the fact that we have a complex system isn't necessarily ideal to people. Not everybody is happy that we have a complex system. So I would still ask the question of how do you know that this is good or isn't good? I mean, I think that the idea that it's not good because it was a concession to reality then carries a lot of weight. And they would have been happier perhaps with a progressive tax. It just wasn't doable. So therefore, the Torah says just do it this way.
Yeah. Taxes were going up in the Torah, were they 100% of them going towards tzedakah?
It depends how you define tzedakah. For example, the 10% that you take to Jerusalem and eat there, that's not tzedakah per se. It's a public cause. We wanted there to be produce in Jerusalem.
Right.
We wanted Jews to go there.
But I'm just wondering in terms of things that tax money is supposedly spent on today.
Yeah.
Infrastructure and things like that.
Right. So that wasn't this. This was actually right. This was personal. This was personal rather than communal construction projects or whatever. Correct.
Right. So was there over and above the taxes that were done?
Yes,
here?
We're getting there.
Okay.
You got it. We're getting there. The other objection that Chodorov brings, which I thought was very sharp, I brought it for you in number 8 on the sheet. He says, the focus on the nominal rate of 10% found in tithing, right, talk about the Maaser tax, ignores the transfer aspects of the rules governing agriculture, meaning transfer of wealth. In years 3 and 6 of the 7-year cycle, the entire second tithe was to be given to the poor. Each year, under the obligations of Peah, Leket, and Shechacha, those are the gleanings that you're leaving behind, the corner of your field that you leave for the needy, produce was to be left in the fields for the poor. This arrangement meant that while all farmers were required to pay the same 10%, the effective rate for the poor farmer was far lower because he had access to the aid to the poor. He received demograms. Demograms are grants done based on demographics, where you give to a particular group. His point is It may be true that everybody is supposed to be giving X percentage to the needy, but since the needy are receiving as well, their tax rate ends up being lower. In other words, it's not truly a proportional income tax, because they are receiving the tax dollars from others. I thought it was a very interesting point that he made, and it's going to come back to in a little bit. He then considers the practice of maser ksafin, the practice of giving 10% of your income, which is post-agricultural. It's something that involves income in general. And he makes a very interesting argument. He wants to suggest that the 10% is not a proportional income tax, because there's a preference for people to give more than that, and there's an allowance for people to give less. If you take a look at source number 9, here I disagreed with him. I don't think he's correct, but he's going to argue with himself, so he saved me the trouble. If you take a look at source number 9 from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, I'm just going with the English in the interest of time, but you can see the Hebrew there. The amount to give for it, meaning for this tzedakah, if one can afford, is whatever the needy require. If one cannot afford so much, he should give up to 20% of his assets. I added the word income because they then adjusted to say income later on. He should give up to 20% of his income for the ideal mitzvah. 10% is the intermediate measure. One should never give less than 1/3 of a shekel per year. So there are some people who are going to give 1/3 of a shekel, there are some people who are going to give 10%, there are some people who give 20%. So he argues that that's actually progressive. And he says, one who gives less has not fulfilled the mitzvah of tzedakah. So the argument is that this is considered a progressive tax. However, he then turns around and says, that's not really a model for a progressive tax today either. Number one, because of the fact that the 20% is voluntary. The 10% is viewed as what you're supposed to do, and the 20% is a nice voluntary number.
Something goes to the poor?
It goes to the needy, correct.
So, aren't we sort of comparing apples and oranges and whether within...
Right, that was Martin's point before also.
Jewish law and secular law, because each of them have progressive rates and each of them have flat rates. Even in secular law, it's our income tax for the government that's progressive, but everyone pays HST the same amount.
Right, that's the argument that you made about VAT also.
Or the gas taxes or whatever, right?
Right. So that's the argument. Correct, that there is a blend today. His question is not what exists today, but what should exist today. Should we be saying across the board, this is the way our taxation should work? Or even if you want to just target income, is this the way our income tax ought to work? But yes, we have a welter of different types of taxes in our system of taxation. Well, that's his point, that it's more complex. Correct. Right. That's his response, is that it is indeed a complex system. But he also argues, going back to the point that Martin made before, that once again, you can't necessarily use this as a model, and he brings it in what I brought in number 10, because what we do with Maser Ksafim, with our 10%, is really personal. It's not about what I'm using to fund communal projects. It's not really analogous to the uses of our income tax. It's a voluntary thing where we individually decide where our money goes. So it's not necessarily the same. Yes?
The half shekel kind of woke the thought for this question. The concept of sacrifice, according to means and circumstances, how does that fit into this model?
Interesting. There is such a thing, you're right, as a sliding scale curve and a sliding scale offering. However, that's talking about where people trigger the obligation by some action. They take a vow, they commit a transgression. It's not a true tax in the sense of something we're going to impose on our citizens. It's something the person takes on by dint of his action. So I'm not sure I look at it as it is an acknowledgement. Well, it's not voluntary. It's actually obligatory based on the situation you put yourself into.
Paying traffic.
I'm not suggesting.
Right, it's like paying a traffic ticket.
I'm not suggesting that.
Sliding scale traffic tickets. There's an idea.
Contributing to sacrifice may be obligatory, but what you sacrifice is based on your circumstances.
Right. Right. No, I agree with you. I'm just not sure I see it in a tax context. I don't see it functioning as it. How would that fit a definition of a tax?
Well, that's right. Which is that part of it is shared, depending on which sacrifice it is, be shared by the client and the thing that can be passed back on.
I guess I'm looking at taxes as not including fines. This is really a fine for conduct, and we're adjusting it based on need. The last of the tax systems within Judaism that he considers is the one that's most relevant in terms of serving communal needs. And that is that the Talmud and later sources talk about taxing a community in order to take care of the needs of the community, but we distinguish between two different types of needs. There's one type of need, which is the needs of the community, let's say defense of the city. And then there's the other type of communal need, which is imposed from outside. Either if we have a community that is living under some foreign government, and the foreign government imposes a tax on us, or the Torah imposes a tax of sorts on a community. There's a religious obligation, that needs to be met. Take a look, please, at source number 11. This is always a controversial source. Passage out of the Talmud. Rabbi Yossi quoted Rabbi Yochanan to say, "Everyone, even minor orphans, gives to the city's defenses. All of us are obligated to support the defense of the city, but not rabbis because they don't require protection. The Torah they're learning is protecting them. Good luck." Rav Papa said, for a wall, when it comes to contributing for a wall, patrols, armor guards, even minor orphans pay, but not rabbis, they don't require protection. The general rule is whoever benefits pays. Even minor orphans. The reason they stress the minor orphan is because normally we say that you appoint a guardian for such a person, and the guardian is only allowed to accrue benefits for them, is not allowed to cause them harm. So you look at it and say, well, how can the guardian take money from them? And the answer is because there's a need for defense of the city, and they had better be a part of that. So what you're seeing here in source number 11 is a basic system of benefits-based taxation. You benefit from it, you pay for it. That's seen also in the distinction of having the rabbis pay for the defense. They do have to pay for other things. The Talmud mentioned they have to pay for, let's say, well, for a water supply, because everybody needs to drink water. There are things they do pay for, just, not everyone pays for everything. You pay if you benefit. That's one system of payment for communal needs, and this one is clearly much closer to what we do with our taxation, in the sense that we use the funds for communal projects. But then you have another side to this. And the other side is when you deal with religious obligations, or something that's imposed by an outside government, or an outside entity, not necessarily a government, as we'll see. So
It didn't say how much they paid, though.
It simply said you're making everybody pay based on benefit. It sounds like it's flat, but it didn't say. When it comes to these other needs, take a look at number 12, for example. We say that residents can force each other to build a synagogue, to acquire a Torah school. Those are religious obligations. The number 13 shows us a debate in terms of how you do it. One view is do it progressively. The other view is make a percentage of it flat. Everyone has to pay a certain amount, and then the rest of it progressive. Take a look at number 13. The Machaber, Rabbi Yosef Karo, and he writes, they pay the cantor from the communal pot. Although he fulfills his role for needy and wealthy alike, the needy cannot afford as the wealthy can, and we saw that already earlier. Right? He's basing himself on Rashba, who we saw in source number 2. So he says it's a tax that everybody's going to have to pay, and it's going to be flat for everybody. Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, says, some say we collect half based on wealth and half as a head tax. And this is the communal custom. So in other words, we say we pay the cantor X amount, 50% of that is going to be divided evenly among everybody, and then 50% of it is going to be done based on what people can afford. We'll do it progressively. Where do you get that from? So the Vilna Gaon said it's source number 14, which once you read it, it's clear that's his source. Caravan is traveling in the wilderness. It's attacked. I should say attacked, not attached. It's attacked by soldiers to loot it. Okay, so someone's coming for your money. They calculated what to pay them off, based on wealth. Whoever has more money to lose is going to have to pay more to them. It's done based on benefit. But if they hire a guide to go before them, you're not under attack now. You hired a guide. You have to travel through the wilderness. If you don't have a guide, You're going to suffer two losses, loss of your life and loss of your wealth. So because of the dual element, they also calculate based on lives. In other words, you have to pay part based on head tax, because everyone's life is at stake, and part of it based on how much wealth you have, because your wealth is at stake as well. So it's a split. You follow? This is the part that's a little more complex. I want to make sure that we're being clear. When we're dealing with the way they used to take care of communal needs, we have some taxes that are benefit-based, although it didn't say how much to give, but it was based on you use it, you pay for it. We have some taxes where there is something progressive. That's the position of the... We have a flat tax when it comes to the position of the Mechaber, the first part of source number 13. Is it actually? By saying it's from the communal pot, I think he's saying progressive.
Progressive.
Progressive, not flat. It's going to be progressive. That's correct. And the position of Rabbi Yisraelis, Rama, in number 13, is that it's half and half. Half flat, half progressive. It gets much more complicated. Now, there are reasons not to do this today. Not to do it based on the benefit system. Number one, implementing a benefit-based system today is incredibly difficult. How are you going to gauge how much members of the community are using the projects that you're working on with this tax money? Right? My tax money goes for the subway. So now we're going to require on your form that you enter how much, you know, how many times you use the subway every year. You know, the roads are built with it. How many times have you been in a hospital? It would be crazy to try to implement a system of taxation based on how much benefit people are getting from it. That's one problem. The other problem, which Khadarov points out in number 15, is that our system of taxation, like the system of the agricultural taxes that we talked about before, in part gives the distributes the tax money to the neediest people. Right? That's part of what our system of taxes does. It transfers wealth. Which means that if you're now going to say the people who receive benefit are the ones who have to pay more, you're going to create a paradox in which the people who are receiving the distribution of the tax money are now going to be responsible to give more back into the system. The needy people who are the beneficiaries, right, when you create a socialized medicine system where you create a system where you're distributing money from the wealthier to the needier, are now going to be the ones who have to pay more taxes if it's really benefits-based.
Trying to make it like a circular
argument. Right. And of course they can't afford to, and then what are you going to do? You're going to give them more out of the tax. It doesn't work. So the bottom line is, out of all of this, we've identified four different systems of taxation that exist within Judaism. The half shekel gift to the temple, the agricultural taxes, the 10%, and the communal taxation, all of them with different systems by which they work: flat, progressive, benefits-based, proportional income-based, and none of them necessarily a good model for today. So it's really hard to say Judaism says this. I also had a side note in here, which I'm not going to do because I want to get to the tax avoidance topic. Yeah.
The idea that it's according to benefit is based on this wilderness fund, but the soldiers are looting?
The idea that it's benefits-based, the soldier looting case shows you a case in which they do 50-50. It's the part of hiring the guide. Where they're going to do, both of them are benefits in a sense, but the idea is that
you make an argument with the soldier one anyway, that it's based on their ability to pay.
Right, so it's not, because they make a distinction between people whose lives are at stake and people whose wealth is at stake. And they say if the lives are at stake, then you do flat. It's not based on ability to pay, it's based on what you stand to lose. If it's wealth, then we do it based on how much wealth you have and therefore how much wealth you would be losing. It's not we're going to charge the wealthier more because they can afford more, because if that were true, we would do it when lives are at stake also. Rather, what we're saying is, if it's if you stand to lose more, therefore you are benefiting more by paying the ransom, we want you to pay more towards the ransom.
I assume when we talk about the ransom case, it's not halacha telling the soldiers how to I assume that's what they normally do when somebody kidnaps.
No, it's telling the Jews who are in this situation, this is what you ought to do. This is how you will pay.
Meaning they're coming to them to be
the attacker is just saying, we want $2 million. And it's up to you to figure out how you're going to do it.
Yeah.
So the question is, how are we going to break it down among ourselves? That's the issue. That's the issue. You follow?
Yeah.
What's the objection over there? I see a head shake.
I don't think it's tax.
Because?
I don't think my definition of tax is tax.
Well, it depends on how you look at it. If we define taxes as a mandatory distribution of your income in order to benefit the group, then why isn't this a tax? How would you adjust the definition?
This was not based on income, it was
based on wealth. It may not be an income tax. It's a different kind of tax. We have a whole host of taxes. You're right, it may not qualify as an income tax. That I definitely hear. All right, I'm looking at the time and realizing that it's getting late. Should I try to go into tax avoidance? Should we hold it for next time? What do you want to do? Our host, I will ask. I don't want to race. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to say about it. I don't want to race through it.
I think maybe we should then stop here.
All right, so next time we'll pick up with the question of tax avoidance. I have a little bit more I'd like to discuss as well in terms of this issue of the two different systems and learning from one system to the other, because there's a lot to be said, which you didn't get to yet, about how cultural values affect not only the question of how much money we're going to take, but how you take it. For example, Khodorov makes a point about accounting periods and the question of, do you have shorter or longer accounting periods which allow people to adjust how they report their income and therefore how much they're going to have to give? And that actually can be determined by what your cultural values are behind your taxation. It was a very, very sharp point that he made. So there are a few things like that I'd like to point out. So God willing, the end of June is our next one. I think it's June 29th will be the date. And we will resume when we'll talk about tax avoidance, part 2. Thank you very much.